Rebecca Mackay. Welcome back to Milwaukee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Always.
Is it true that the AIDS crisis was initially a subplot for you in this book?
Yes, which I then became very quickly uncomfortable with. And I really started initially with this idea of a woman who had been an artist's model around World War I in Paris. That was my initial, you know, I was sitting in a cab, I had this idea, this is my book, right? So I thought I want her at the end of her life looking back, basic math that couldn't have been later than the 80s. So I feel like, okay, I have her in the 80s. She's in conversation with some art guy in the 80s about these sketches she has of her from that time. I have an art guy in the 80s. That's an excuse to write about the AIDS crisis, which is something I've been interested in for my whole life, basically, but interested in writing about for a while. I had a story in my story collection about the AIDS crisis. And for me, as I consider a novel, I have about a year-long period, usually, where I'm just working it over mentally. I am not writing anything. And during that time, I feel really embarrassed when anyone asks me about my work. There's this scene, do you guys remember Amadeus in 1984, the Tom Hulce movie? And he's like totally drunk, and he's the mysterious man in black comes to ask him if he's been working on the Requiem he's supposed to be writing, and he's totally drunk, and he's like, yes, I have it all written down. And the guy's like, where is it? And he's like, it's all up here in my noodle. That's what I feel like during that year of like, yes, I'm writing. And if I had to turn to any pages, there are no pages, and I feel nuts. But during that time, I'm reconsidering a lot of things. I'm rearranging a lot of things mentally. And one of the things that happened during that time was a couple things. One was as I started to research, starting to get the lay of the land through research on art world of lost generation Paris, and I'm starting to get the lay of the land on Chicago AIDS generation. And the gravity was starting to shift really rapidly. It's not that, you know, I'm constantly going to be in love with lost generation Paris, but it felt like the tenor of the metaphor. It felt like the thing that should be mentioned, you know, out of scene, where AIDS generation Chicago was just stealing the gravity. So that's one thing. And the other thing was,
I was just going to say, so when you said before you were uncomfortable with AIDS only being a subplot.
That's the thing. So this is the second thing. I was thinking about the number of movies, TV shows, books that I've consumed in which AIDS is a subplot. And some of them are masterpieces. I don't, you know, there's nothing wrong with them individually. But taken collectively, I think most of what mainstream America consumes is AIDS as a whitewashed subplot, where typically someone is diagnosed, it may be not the main character, they die very melodramatically, but very cleanly off stage.
Mark Harmon in St. Elsewhere.
Yes, exactly. Very typically, the way that their death is realized is someone goes to visit them in the hospital, and the hospital bed is empty, right? Which I think, if I ever wrote an essay about this, it would be called The Empty Bed, right? Like, it's we didn't have to see it, we didn't have to deal with it, but isn't it dramatic, isn't it symbolic? And now back to the main story. And I just couldn't bear to do that. And again, individually, and I'm not calling St. Elsewhere a masterpiece, but there are masterpieces of art, right, that do this. It's not any one of them individually. It's the fact that collectively it starts to become a problem. Why is it pushed off to the side? Let's actually focus on it. Let's look at Dead in the Eyes. I just couldn't do it as a subplot.
You said you have wanted to write about, you've been interested in and you've wanted to write about AIDS generation Chicago or elsewhere for practically your whole life, I'm assuming your whole professional life anyway.
Yeah.
You are, I believe, a bit younger than me. So I was in high school when much of the past, the stories of Yale and Charlie and Nico and others play out. Do you have firsthand memories of that time that underpin the era as you describe it?
Yes, but they are remote. They have to do with what I saw on TV. You know, my parents had one colleague. My parents were in academia. They had one colleague who my mother was close to who died of AIDS, but I don't think I knew about that until I was a little bit older. It was no one I knew. I really believe, it's really interesting. I think I talk to anyone a little bit younger than me, they don't understand at all. I talk to anyone a little bit older than me and they go, yeah, I understand, but why would you, you know, why were you drawn to do this? And I talk to people just about exactly my age, and to be honest, I'm 40, so I think people get it instantly. people exactly my age, how foundational this understanding was for maybe not everyone, for a lot of us. You know, you watch the news, I mean, because this is, you know, we're all staying up until midnight and watching 2020 because, you know, it's the 80s, whatever, no one cares. You stay home from school sick, you watch Donahue, you pick it up, right? Whatever it was that I saw, and it wasn't coming from my home, it was not coming from school, it was from TV, to be fully honest. As a child, it was coming at me. And I had a child's porous sense of empathy, where I had not been taught to otherize these people, because my parents never talked about that stuff at all. I had not been, I didn't have any pre-existing prejudices, experiences, anything. This was John Stossel or whoever talking to me and me going, oh my God.
You weren't old enough to be jaded.
Not at all. No. I instantly felt for these people. I instantly, I think, identified them as my people, which has been born out in life, and was horrified and got it. And I had a really weird experience as I was researching. I ended up watching on YouTube. I believe it was Donahue. I was joking about that, but there was a Donahue episode. It was a bunch of members of the New York chapter of ACT UP talking on Donahue in, I'm going to guess, 1989 or 1990. I was watching it, and about halfway through went, oh my God, I saw this. I saw this when it was first on. I was 10, I was 11, I was 12, I was somewhere in there. It wasn't when they were talking, it was when someone in the audience, some woman stood up and said, what about this idea of quarantining everyone on an island? And I went, I saw that. And I was upset. And I was in my family room, and I don't remember beyond that, but I saw this. And, you know, these people were going on this show. There was this, you know, this panel of people. They were pleading for their lives. They're trying to speak to people contemporaneously. They're, you know, and, you know, I would love to take a time machine back and tell them, you know, you were also reaching children, you know, that there, maybe we shouldn't have been watching daytime TV, there are better ways to center. But like, you know, I'm sure that in their mind, they were thinking, I'm speaking to people my age, I'm speaking to politicians, I'm speaking to policymakers right now. And you were also speaking to 10-year-olds who were homesick from school, who listened and who got it.
So it was in the background, at least until sex ed in high school. You're experiencing it kind of, I don't want to say vicariously, because that's not quite the right word, but you're experiencing it secondhand. What was your process like to appreciate the feel of what it was like to experience that era firsthand?
Yeah, so this is very different, right? I really believe strongly, and I'm glad that I knew this from the beginning, because I didn't waste any time, that you can't empathize your way all the way into that point of view. I had the empathy. I had the, you know, I have an overactive imagination. That's going for me. I could not have just sat down in a vacuum and correctly empathized, correctly imagined this experience. So here's the thing. As I set out to do my research, I realized very quickly that there is nothing in book or film form about the AIDS crisis in Chicago. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the same is probably true for Milwaukee. When we look at what is recorded, it's New York, San Francisco, it might be LA, it might be Paris and London. Chicago, you know, wasn't it's the third biggest city in America. There are pages in coffee table books, you know, out and proud in Chicago, 1812 to 2013, and you have three pages in there. Chicago's not even in the index of a book like How to Survive a Plague by David France and the band played on, right? And Chicago is the least of the issue. You know, Milwaukee, which, sidebar, you guys know, I've been telling the story everywhere just as an example of why the stories of other cities need to be told. The 1993 Cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee, which went in the news as having killed a couple of hundred people, largely the elderly and those with compromised immunity. What that meant was that basically everyone with HIV within the city of Milwaukee died in about 2 weeks. It was not reported. It was completely swept under the rug. And I sat down with someone at one point from Chicago who had Milwaukee roots, and he's trying to show me photo albums. And one of the things he thinks is a photo album is actually a scrapbook of funeral bulletins. And he opens it up, and they're all flying every direction, something that I actually wrote into my book later, a scene very much like this. And the reason they'd all been stuffed in there, and he'd never organized them, is they were all from Milwaukee within about a month of each other. And, you know, so that story is so different from the story of San Francisco. It's so different from the story of New York. And those aren't the stories that people absorb. They're, you know, people think they know this narrative. They have no idea, and it's absolutely different. And then you have cities like, so I was in Dubuque, Iowa last week. You would not think that that was a place where the AIDS epidemic struck. Here's what you have, a medium-sized city. It's the kind of city you leave if you're young and gay, right? So people did that. They moved home when they were dying. So one of the people who came to my reading was this doctor who was an epidemiologist, who was the guy that people would come to in Dubuque if they had something like this. So he's the guy who's suddenly dealing with 20, 30 cases of AIDS in Dubuque, Iowa, which you would not think, right, would have its own story. Anyway. So I set out to research Chicago. This is not a story that's out there. It's not been published, and which kills me, which meant that what I had to do was primary source research. I holed up in the Harold Washington Library downtown, and I read every back issue of the Windy City Times, which is Chicago's major gay weekly, from 1985 to 1992, which was quite an education. And then I did hours and hours and hours of first-person interviews. So doctors, nurses, survivors, journalists, historians, activists, which for my writing was a blessing in disguise, because at this point, you know, I wasn't hiding behind a desk. It was not just factual research, it was emotional research. I was able to get the texture on things. I made friends who could then read the book and tell me where I'd gotten something just slightly wrong. Literally, two of the notes I got from readers, one was, the floor of that bar was really sticky. And the other was, and he was so serious. We're sitting across from each other in a coffee shop, and he's like, I just really don't think that at that time of the night, you could have walked east from that street and gotten a cheeseburger. I was, for my own work, I'm so glad that I was forced into those first-person interviews and so grateful for the people who gave me their time. On the broader scale, I'm really freaked out that this stuff is not chronicled in nonfiction, in film, or in book form. And that's my soapbox right now. We need to get it written down.
Well, and I was wondering, is there a point at which the history kind of stops? I mean, you said you went back through the Windy City Times through, like, 1992. Is there a point at which people stopped looking at that era?
Not the Windy City Times. You know, I stopped there because that's when chronologically, you know, so people haven't read the book. There are two major time periods in the book. I have the 80s, and that it's largely 85, 86, but it goes through 92. But then every other chapter is 2015 Paris, where the woman whose brother's memorial service starts the book is trying to track down her estranged daughter. There's all this other stuff going on that we're not necessarily addressing right now about cults and all kinds of other things. But largely, you know, largely the time frame of the book is 85 to 92. So I'm stopping in 92 in part because I need to limit my knowledge, right? But no, I think something like the Windy City Times, absolutely not. They are still absolutely chronicling it, absolutely never stopped, right? But I've been appalled at the number of people who have said things to me like, wow, there must be so many parallels to the modern day, which I understand the sentiment. Yes, absolutely, we can make parallels to, you know, regimes that don't consider you a human, things like that. There are 35 million people in the world living with HIV right now. That's not a parallel. It's still happening, right? A 1.1 million of those are in America. Doesn't take a lot of explanation to understand, you know, a lot of that is in Africa. That's why we're turning a blind eye, which is very problematic. AIDS is still the eighth leading cause of death for Americans aged 25 to 34. And I'm getting comments all the time from people going like, yeah, I remember that time, you know, that was really bad, but now it's such a manageable condition. It's almost like just having diabetes or asthma. It's not. I'm disturbed to see that for many of the same reasons that originally a blind eye was turned, it's those people over there, marginalized people, it's them, that's never going to happen to me, never mind. We finally acknowledged it. We finally addressed it. As a nation, we looked at it, not perfectly, but we looked at it. And again, we're turning a blind eye to it for other reasons very similar to the original ones, which is that now it's largely African Americans who have this, who have HIV. It's largely people in Africa rather than the United States who have HIV. And so again, it's that it's over there. It's not an issue. I'm not going to think about it. I feel like it's a return to silence and a return to ignorance in a way that I look at these people that I have come to worship, these early people in ACT UP, and you know, some of them are still around. I know them, and I know how horrified they are by that return to ignorance. And I think about some of the ones who gave their lives in this fight and how horrified they would be. And I just, you know, it's troubling.
There's a point at which Nora, Fiona's aunt,
great aunt,
makes a comparison between the Chicago gay community during the AIDS crisis and her community in Paris in the wake of World War I.
Yeah.
Was that something that came to you in creating this story, or is that a comparison that others have made?
If anyone else has made it, I don't know.
It's such a powerful thought.
Yeah, I mean, it originated in my mind for me. Someone else certainly might have made it, and I think for very logical reasons. No, really what happened was I was starting with this idea of the art scene in Paris around World War I, that lost generation art scene. And here's what really happened. As I was reading, and I was thinking about the AIDS generation already, I was reading this wonderful book called Flappers, Six Women of a Dangerous Generation. And I don't know if they have it here, but I highly recommend it. It basically takes six different women. One is Zelda Fitzgerald, one is Tamara DeLempicka, the artist, one is Isadora Duncan. And just talking about these remarkable women in the 20s, usually, you know, mostly for the 20s. And in one of the sections, and I don't remember which, probably Zelda Fitzgerald, it quotes F. Scott Fitzgerald as saying, "We were the great believers." And I was so taken aback by that, because this is the generation of which Gertrude Stein said to Hemingway, "You are all a lost generation." And that seemed like an utter contrast to me. I was so interested in that quote and where it came from. So I looked up the quote, and it comes from a really obscure essay by Fitzgerald that was published posthumously in Esquire, and I've used it as the epigraph on the book, and I'll read it to you. It's funny how many people will have read the whole book and then ask me where the title came from, and I'm like, "You skipped the first page, didn't you, dude?" Can't do that. Okay, so the quote is...
People are waiting for the big quote on page 118.
Right, exactly, that's it, right. So the quote is, "We were the great believers. I have never cared for any men as much as for these who felt the first springs when I did and saw death ahead and were reprieved and who now walk the long stormy summer." And that to me, as I'm also researching AIDS Generation Chicago, I'm thinking about the survivors, right? I'm thinking about the people who now 30 years later are here. They were handed a death sentence 30 years ago and here they still are. Or they were there with their friends, they lost their entire generation. They're the only one left alive with that legacy, and I talked to so many of those people. That idea of the long stormy summer became completely fascinating to me. And it wasn't until later that I actually put it together and realized I had to include the then modern day in the book. I was really fascinated by the parallels. You look at this generation in Paris. We tend to think of the writers, the American writers who came there after World War I. The visual artists were coming there before World War I. We have people from all over Europe. You have people, actually all over the world, because you have people like Soutine, Modigliani, but you have Fujita coming from Japan. People coming from often, you know, godforsaken shtetls in, you know, remote Russian villages, getting to Paris, sometimes against the will of their family. It's the age of the Art Academy. They're studying, they're forming chosen family. They're in this metropolis, they're finding happiness. And then World War I rolls through and the influenza of 1918 rolls through like a bulldozer. and it kills almost entirely young men, young, fit, able-bodied men is who it kills. And then you have that same generation regrouping after the war, trying to move on. That's when Stein calls them the lost generation. And the parallels between that and a city like Chicago or a city like Milwaukee in the AIDS generation, the people who had come there from everywhere to find happiness, to find chosen family, and they had found it. And then AIDS rolls through. Not only that time, but the regrouping, the aftermath. That those parallels fascinated me. That was the, you know, the original backbone of the book, and I think it stays there through the end.
Do you want to give people a flavor for a section of this book?
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah. Cool. I'll read you something really short. So it's much, you know, I feel like, I always feel like you do a bookstore event and it's like, what's the point in reading to people for 15 minutes? Like, you're all literate. That's why you're here. So I'm going to read something really short. So, okay. If you haven't read the book, in the 80s, my main character is a guy named Yale Tishman. And we're really following him from the memorial service at the beginning of his first close friend to die of AIDS. For the next 7 years, as his life both unravels and takes on much greater meaning. But the guy who died in the beginning, the guy his memorial service it was a guy named Nico. His little sister, Fiona, she's only 21 in 85, but we meet her in 2015. She's 51. She's traveled to Paris to track down her estranged daughter. I think I mentioned that before. She nursed many friends through the ends of their lives in the 80s. After her brother died, she postponed college. She just stayed with these people. So she, because circumstances are forcing this on her in 2015, is confronting some of that emotional trauma for the first time. And so the deal is she's staying with a friend named Richard. He's a guy, the first scene of the novel takes place in his house, which he's volunteered for this memorial service. And in the 80s, we knew him as sort of an amateur photographer, but by 2015, he's a world famous photographer. And he's famous in large part for chronicling the AIDS epidemic in Chicago. So she's at this point alone in his place in Paris. And there were some photo albums that he tried to show her when she first arrived that she wasn't really ready to see, but she's ready to look at them now. And you'll hear echoes. I described a scene earlier with someone with the Milwaukee connections, and you'll see exactly how that played into the book. There were probably 20 albums on the shelf. Oh, I'm sorry. Really quickly before I start. The one thing you need to know about Fiona is that in her adult life, she runs a resale shop in Chicago that benefits AIDS housing. If you know Chicago, it's loosely based on the Brown Elephant in Chicago, although it's quite different. There were probably 20 albums on the shelf, a fact Fiona hadn't absorbed that first day. Rows of black leather, brown leather, colored canvas. Boxes full of slides as well, but she wouldn't mess with those. When she pulled a thick red album off the shelf, though, a paper slipped out and landed on the floor. Fiona attempted to clutch the album closed before anything else fell, but she dropped the whole thing, and now there were papers everywhere. Cream-colored sheets folded in half, small cards, a lavender page with a grainy photo of a man. They were funeral bulletins, she realized, and prayer cards. She got on her knees and started stacking them up. This wasn't a photo album at all, she saw, when she opened it to an old clipping from Out Loud Chicago, an obituary of someone who danced with the Alvin Ailey Theater. Jesus. She opened the album at the beginning and tried to slide the papers back into the empty spots. A man named Oscar, no one she remembered, had died in 1984. A clipping about Katsu Tatami from 1986. Here was the bulletin for Terrence Robinson, Nico's Terrence. How odd. She must have put this bulletin together herself, but she didn't remember it. Jonathan Bird, Dwight Sumner. There were so many of them, so impossibly many. In her current life, it happened at least once a week that someone would wander into the store, and then, when they discovered its mission, say something like, "Oh, I remember that time." Fiona had learned to check her temper, to push her toes into the floor so her face didn't change. "I knew someone whose cousin had it," they'd continue. Did you ever see Philadelphia? And they'd shake their heads in dismay. And how could she answer? They meant well, all of them. How could she explain that this city was a graveyard? That they were walking every day through streets where there had been a Holocaust, a mass murder of neglect and antipathy? That when they stepped through a pocket of cold air, didn't they understand it was a ghost? It was a boy the world had spat out. Here in her hand, a stack of ghosts. So I'll stop there.
Was there any single part of that period that was hardest for you to wrap your head around?
Yeah. I think one of the big misprisions that I had going into it from this side of the millennium was, so 1985 is the year the test came out, right? It's been, you know, the AIDS has been around for a while. 1982 is when the New York Times article comes out. There's some media coverage. 85 is when the FDC approves the test for what was then called HTLV-3, but what we now call HIV. From this side of the millennium, it's pretty clear that everyone should get tested and know their status, and that's a really good thing to do, right? I was not aware until I started writing, until I started researching, of the absolute mistrust, the absolute confusion, the absolute, you know, it was not clear in 1985 or 86 or 87 that you should get tested. So many reasons. First of all, there's no medication. There's nothing. So do you want to know? And if you let people know, are they just going to kill themselves? Are they just going to have more reckless behavior that's going to actually spread this rather than curtail it? If you get tested, are those results going to be co-opted by the government in some way? Are you going to be quarantined? Is your doctor going to be subpoenaed? Is that possible? Are the results even reliable? Is this whole thing, you know, in some way rigged? There is no trust, and there were a million different points of view on this. There was massive protesting against the Howard Brown Clinic in Chicago, the major place where you might get testing now, against them offering the test, and they didn't test it. They didn't offer it for about a year after it was approved by the FDC. So, or FDA, I don't know what, FDA?
Probably FDA. FTC would be the Federal Trade Commission.
Yeah, no, that's not good. The FCC is the radio, the FTC, okay, the FDA. The FAA is not it either.
Not the FBI.
The FDA is what I meant to say. So, you know, there's a whole year of lag time before they are willing to offer it, and then in the face of massive protest. That, to me, was an initial challenge. Ultimately, it was very helpful for me because I've chosen to start my novel in 1985, kind of chose it randomly, and then realized that this was a really interesting year. Was able to form some of my character decisions around, you know, I have a broad cast of characters. Who is advocating for the test? Who is fighting against it? Who is fine but is not going to get tested? Who is going to argue against it politically but then go get tested personally? Mm-hmm. You know, that helped me differentiate my characters in a really interesting way. So it was a little litmus test for them.
What is it like as an author to wake up one morning and your book is on the cover of the New York Times Book Review?
Well, I didn't find it in the morning. I found it in the afternoon.
I was being metaphorical.
No, it's great. It's, you know, I think this is always a roller coaster ride. It's always, there's a tipping point that's nothing I've reached. There's a tipping point where no matter what you do, a book is a runaway success. So think of something like All the Light We Cannot See, right? That author could have hidden in a cave for 5 years. The book would have sold as much as it did, right? I'm not anywhere near that tipping point. So I'm incredibly grateful for everything that's come my way. This is still a book that I need to follow around like an anxious mother, you know, hoping that one more person reads it. And I'm still so grateful for word of mouth and social media and all those things. So those things, I don't mean to sound ungrateful. Those things make you happy for a couple days and then you're back to, you know, filling out forms for the book festival you need to do to get behind the book and you know, push it to more people. So it's fabulous. I think it's, you know, there's been a different response. There's been a different magnitude of response to this book than to my previous books, and I'm incredibly grateful for that. It's still in the same category, kind of like, please buy my book, please, 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 you know, and that's fine. You know, that's all you ever expect. And I think you're just the gratitude that I feel isn't for those, you know, big moments of publicity. It's for the fact that I'm allowed to do this for a living. You know, that to be among the storytellers of the human race, I think, is a tremendous honor, and not one that I ever take for granted. And that, you know, just to be able to keep doing that matters more to me than those individual moments with any book.
There is something about bearing witness to this place and this time and this community in a way that almost no one else has. That's pretty powerful.
It's really interesting that I certainly, you know, like I said, the book started elsewhere. I was never like, I alone shall be the one to tell the story of, you know, that's never my ambition or my intention. But the book did feel more urgent when I realized that the story of Chicago hadn't been told. What I didn't realize, and I feel like there are surely exceptions out there, but as I was researching and as I was writing, I absorbed all the nonfiction that I could, but I stayed very far away from fiction about the AIDS epidemic. Even as it was being recommended to me often, you know, as I interviewed people, they'd go, oh my gosh, have you read The Heart's Invisible Furies? Which sounds amazing, but I needed to stay away from it, because if I'm reading nonfiction or if I'm interviewing someone and I get a really interesting detail, I can use it. If I'm reading fiction and I get a really interesting detail, that's plagiarism. That's not okay. So I have to steer clear of that stuff. So I think for that reason, I had been unaware until the New York Times book review came out with Michael Cunningham saying that as far as he knows, it's the first to chronicle the span, right? Like, you know, from its origins to the modern day of the AIDS epidemic. And I'm sure there are exceptions to that, but I think, you know, his being unaware of those might mean that those are maybe not as prominent, and maybe there are ones that we should be raising into prominence, maybe there are other, so I don't know. But for me, as I researched and as I wrote, I was originally going to set it just in the 80s. And then in my in-person interviews, I became so fascinated as I talk to people now, not as much about what they were saying about the 80s, although that was fascinating, but about what they were implying about that 30-year span of time, that gap, and about their lives now, and about, you know, that long stormy summer that Fitzgerald speaks of, that, you know, what do you do with your life afterwards? And the things like, you know, people saying to me things like, you know, they talk forever and ever about some friend they lost in 1986 and say, you know, if he'd survived, we would have drifted apart. And he would have just been another person I knew in my 20s, and I wouldn't even remember him that much. But because I was one of the closest people to him when he died, I feel responsible for him, because I'm one of the only people who remembers him. And so I have to keep telling his story. And that kind of psychological burden was so fascinating to me. So it became for me about that gap. I realized, you know, Fiona needed the modern day story, and that it became about time for me in so many ways.
So ultimately this is fiction, and I mean, as you say, I imagine your hope is that people will be intrigued as they read the book and then buy copies for all of their friends and relatives.
Yes.
But beyond those important aspirations, what is the conversation that you hope that this novel sparks, yeah, either internally or among readers?
Yeah, I mean, there I could answer in 15 different ways. I'll pick one, which is that I think that we need to get the stories of individual cities that are not New York and not San Francisco. I mean, keep telling those stories too, right? But the small, you know, Denver, Orlando, Minneapolis, Madison, we need those stories to be chronicled, to be written down. I'm sure there are some of them that have been, but you'd be amazed how many have not. And we have people, you know, I was, so the 50th anniversary of Stonewall is coming up this June. And that's huge. That's very exciting. I was kind of taken aback looking at that, realizing that means these guys are in their 70s. And Stonewall itself has been very well chronicled. We should get everyone's story of every single person who was there. We should continue doing that. But, you know, these guys, a lot of these people I'm writing about, they would, you know, they are or would be in their 60s, in their 70s. We need to get these people's stories in writing, in film, now. We don't have time to waste. There will be other crises like this. First of all, this is ongoing. Trump fired all the remaining members of the HIV/AIDS Advisory Council between Christmas and New Year's of last year, despite the fact that 1.1 million Americans are living with HIV. This is still going on. But there will be another health crisis, and it will affect marginalized people again. And again, we will not be paying attention, and the government will not be paying attention. You know, at the time when this book starts, tens of thousands of men were dead, and Reagan had not said the word AIDS in public. That's going to happen again. And we can learn from this history. We, you know, this should be being taught. I don't mean this. I don't mean my book. Sorry. This book.
It probably should be also.
Right. No. The AIDS epidemic, I'm just gesturing like my leg, okay. The AIDS epidemic should be being taught in schools to the extent that we teach World War II. And for the same reasons, namely, to understand America as it was and as it is, that cause and effect, and so that this does not happen again. You know, you go to your uncle's house who's really into history, and he has 55 books on World War II and so many books on the Civil War. Where are the books about AIDS on that guy's shelf? I mean, there are books about AIDS. That's not what I'm saying. But like that, you know, the people who care deeply about American history, why is that not a week and a half of American high school right now? And I mean, I know it's because, you know, your average history teacher gets up to Watergate and it's like, oh, it's June 1st. Sorry, guys. The final's on Tuesday, right? But this is as important, if not more important, right, than the Civil War. Okay, great, let's spend a week on it. Let's spend a week and a half on this. This is going to happen again. It's gonna happen soon, right? Like something like this is going to happen, or the same thing is going to continue to happen that has actually been happening.
Well, unless there's another pressing question, I think I'm gonna turn you over to the signing line. But
thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Oh my gosh. Really quickly, thank you to Boswell. Amazon does not do this for you or for me. Please spend some money here tonight. Thank you, Daniel. And I'm really happy to answer more questions as you get books signed. Thank you.